a lot of questions and appeared interested. Later that Tuesday, Ben, Peter, and I agreed on the final GE Honeywell offer. Peter wrote Ben a letter defining what dollar level and specific divestitures would satisfy our obligations under the merger agreement. It had been a struggle for us to go that far, but we felt we could still make the deal work at this level. The agreed $2.2 billion list of divestitures was what we would propose by June 14th, the final deadline for submitting a proposal under the Commission's rules. Peter's letter gave us another $340 million sweetener that I could offer Commissioner Monti the next day in an effort to close the deal. That would bring us to the $2.2 billion of concessions. Everyone suggested I go alone to that session on June 13th, not knowing if I'd meet with Commissioner Monti by himself or with others. I walked into Mr. Monti's office on Rue de la Loi and was greeted by his assistant, who seemed surprised that I had shown up by myself. "Where's your staff?" she asked. "It's only me. I'm here to listen to the official response to our latest offer." Mr. Monti came out and escorted me into his office. After a brief and cordial exchange, we entered a conference room filled with officials of the merger task force and their staff members. After laying my briefcase on the table, I took a seat on one side of the table. Across from me sat 8 to 10 government officials. Besides Commissioner Monti, there was Enrique Gonzalez-Diaz, the head of the merger task force investigation team, Alexander Schaub, Director General of Competition, and Getz Drowse, Director of the merger task force. Commissioner Monti opened the meeting by reading a statement that thanked our team for its good efforts. He concluded his remarks by saying our proposal was inadequate and then continued reading a scripted series of demands. I took notes as Commissioner Monti suggested we divest one Honeywell business after another. The divestitures he was suggesting added up to somewhere in the neighborhood of $5 billion to $6 billion and basically took any notion of a merger between GE and Honeywell off the table. "Mr. Monti, I'm shocked and stunned by these demands," I said. "There's no way I could consider this. If that's your position, I'll go home tonight. I've got a book to write." Across the table, Alexander Schaub, a heavy-set, round-faced German, broke out laughing. "That can be your last chapter, Mr. Welch," he said. "Go home, Mr. Welch," is a perfect title. The remark broke the tension in the room. Everyone had a good chuckle, but my heart sank. There was a brief additional discussion about a full or partial sale of GE Capital Aviation Services, GECAS, our aircraft financing and leasing business, plus significant other divestitures. This went nowhere. I had a second meeting with Mr. Monti that evening. This session lasted no longer than 20 minutes. I told him we had gone just about as far as we could go and Honeywell was in agreement. I told him we would submit our final offer the following day. He nodded and I left. The next day, June 14th, we spoke briefly on the phone. I included the final Honeywell divestiture of $340 million that took our offer to $2.2 billion. "I was embarrassed to bring it out last night because we were billions of dollars apart," I said, "but it will be in our final submission." He thanked me for letting him know, but showed no interest in the offer. We went to our lawyers' offices where the teams from Honeywell and GE had gathered for weeks. We were all devastated. While I had only several meetings with the task force, both our teams had spent countless hours slugging it out with them. The formal GE Honeywell submission was sent late that day to the Commission's offices, describing the full divestitures of $2.2 billion. Prior to leaving Brussels, Commissioner Monti called to wish me well. He told me our dealings had been pleasant, and for the first time, he called me Jack. I thanked him and said goodbye to Mario. "Now that the deal is over," he said, "I can say to you, goodbye, Jack." Well, goodbye, Mario. At that moment, I couldn't believe that they'd pass up all these goodies. Along with our U.S. divestiture, it brought the total amount of concessions to about $2.5 billion, about 40% of the key aerospace product lines. I hoped the merger task force would have to think twice about what was on the table. The task force's decision got a lot of attention. Many newspapers and magazines were critical of the Commission's rejection of our deal. Some politicians in Washington publicly attacked the decision and urged the Commission to reconsider. After public pressure began to build, we agreed with Honeywell to make one last try. So on Monday, June 25th, Dennis, Ben, and I met in New York with Mike Bonsignore and Peter Krendler. We agreed to offer to sell 19.9% of GECAS in a private placement to one or more third-party investors of GE's choice and to invite one independent director on the five-person GECAS board. We said we would never accept having our competitors as minority shareholders in GECAS. Mike and Peter agreed. We discussed aerospace divestitures and agreed to couple the 19.9% GECAS sale with an offer to divest Honeywell properties with $1.1 billion of sales, half the $2.2 billion offer on June 14th. Mike and Peter agreed this was the last step we needed to take. The following morning, I called Mr. Monti and asked if he would see Mike Bonsignore and me in Brussels so that we could submit our latest proposal. He thought it was inappropriate to see us now, preferring that our European lawyers present the new proposal. I asked him to convey the same message to Mike Bonsignore. Mike and I said we were ready to go to Brussels if we got the signal from Commissioner Monti. Our lawyers did as instructed, and Commissioner Monti got back to us quickly. On Thursday, June 28th, in an afternoon conference call with Mike and me, Mr. Monti called our last offer insufficient. He said that if we had submitted it 2 months earlier, it wouldn't have been enough. We tried to be responsive to what we were hearing, and after all we put into it, this is obviously disappointing, I told him. Mike Bonsignore echoed similar feelings. Mike called me back about 5:30 p.m. and told me he was going to send over a last request in the morning. I suggested that we had given it everything we had and all we'd do now is irritate the commission. Jack, I've got to give it one last desperate shot, he said. The next morning, I received a new proposal from Honeywell. In a 2-page letter that Mike also released to the public, he asked me to return to our June 14th proposal of $2.2 billion of divestitures. But he also asked us to modify our GECAS proposal so that the European Commission would have to approve the minority investor and independent board member. In short, in response to the Commission's position, Honeywell was proposing all the previous divestitures plus an onerous GECAS concept. In exchange, Mike proposed a revision of the merger agreement. He lowered the price for Honeywell, reducing the exchange ratio from 1.055 shares of GE for every Honeywell share to 1.01 shares of GE for every Honeywell share. It was unacceptable. Jeff Immelt, who had been involved in every Honeywell decision since becoming chairman-elect in December, agreed with me and our vice chairman that the proposal didn't make sense. We all felt terrible for the people in both companies who had devoted months to the deal, working on the details of the integration plans. But we couldn't go along with Honeywell's proposal. I then called the GE board, explained our position, and got its approval to turn down Honeywell's proposed revision of the merger agreement. This was not a hard decision. The Commission had destroyed the strategic reasons for doing the deal. What the Commission is seeking cuts the heart out of the strategic rationale of our deal, I wrote in a letter to Mike. The new deal you propose in response to the Commission makes no sense for our share owners for the same strategic reasons. The Commission's rejection of the Honeywell acquisition was unfortunate for both partners. It made so much sense. All of us tried very hard to make the deal work. For me, if this deal had come along in the middle of my career, it would have been another swing and miss. Coming at the very end, after I had postponed my retirement, the loss of GE's biggest deal seemed to loom larger. It was never a personal battle between Commissioner Monti and myself. He and I always had cordial dealings, and our teams made many efforts to overcome our differences. Unfortunately, we were operating under a set of rules that allowed the Commission to function as both the opposing team and the umpire. Once the merger task force struck at the strategic rationale for the deal, it wasn't in the interest of our share owners. This wasn't about me. It was about them, and our employees are our largest share owners. Over the weekend, I was having cocktails at a post-wedding reception on the porch of the country club of Fairfield, looking out over the golf course and Long Island Sound. This is a gorgeous piece of property, surrounded by water. My friends were asking me what happened to the Honeywell deal. I pointed out to the grounds and said, "Just imagine if you bought this beautiful golf course, and in order to close the purchase, the city officials demanded that holes 2, 3, 4, 5, and 8, the best holes along the water, must be given to another golf course in the area. And then they ask you to give up part of your own house." Understanding that helped them understand my Brussels experience. In today's highly regulated and litigious world, where corporations are easy targets, the dangers of unchecked bureaucracy are a constant thorn in the CEO's side. In our case, we've had two instances where we've been denied any kind of reasonable due process. With the EPA's use of the Superfund law, the rule is you either do the cleanup they demand or face treble damages and a $27,500 a day penalty. Your right of appeal only kicks in after all the work is completed, years later. That lack of due process is why we've challenged the constitutionality of this law in federal court. With the European Commission's rejection of the Honeywell acquisition, again, there was no viable review process. The bureaucrats can take the most extreme positions and not have any incentive to compromise. In the United States, antitrust authorities have to get a court order to stop a deal. Not in Europe. Companies should have the right to a fair and public hearing in a reasonable time by an impartial tribunal. Only governments can tackle this inequity. Going forward, companies must fight for the same rights as someone contesting a traffic ticket, their timely day in court. Chapter 24. What this CEO thing is all about. Being a CEO is the nuts. A whole jumble of thoughts come to mind. Over the top, wild, fun, outrageous, crazy, passion, perpetual motion, the give and take, meetings into the night, incredible friendships, fine wine, celebrations, great golf courses, big decisions in the real game, crises and pressure, lots of swings, a few home runs, the thrill of winning, the pain of losing. It's as good as it gets. You get paid a lot, but the real payoff is in the fun. Like any job, though, it has its pluses and minuses, but the good sure overwhelms the bad. The schedule is packed with many hours blocked out a year in advance, yet every day manages to bring new crises that butcher your calendar. The days are crazy long, yet the hours race by because you're always fighting for more time. The job never leaves you, no matter what you're doing. What's on your mind is always so absorbing. There are all kinds of boring external functions, but none internally. Well, at least not for me, because I set the agenda. I was invited to a lot of black tie dinners and industry association meetings. The best thing is, I didn't have to go. Some of the dinners are real special, like the White House state dinners you wish your parents were alive to see. I got to meet lots of bright people I'd otherwise only read about, and I found most of them self-effacing and fun. There's no such thing as a typical day. While I was working on this book in late May, I happened to have a day that was packed wall-to-wall with meetings from 8:30 in the morning until 8:30 at night. The next day, Warner Books CEO Larry Kirschbaum was ragging me about why I hadn't gotten more done on the book. "For Christ's sakes, Larry, there was no way I could do anything yesterday. I had a crazy day. What happened?" he asked. When I told him, he insisted I put it in the book. The day started at 8:30 a.m. with what we often call Deal Day, when the GE Capital Board met for its monthly session. This time, we had a full plate to review, ranging from a bid for a bankrupt life insurance company in Japan with $5.5 billion in assets to a $500 million loan for a power plant in Mississippi. Dennis Naden, CEO of GE Capital, introduced the rationale for each deal before the business leaders and their teams came in to pitch. GE Treasurer Jim Bunt is responsible for analyzing the deals with the GE Capital teams. The day prior to the meeting, he circulated via email a 1-to-2-page summary of each deal along with his personal recommendation. A GE Capital board member for years, Jim has always been the resident cynic, a brilliant madman who manages to find humor and hidden perils in the numbers. In the fall of 2000, I made a deal to keep him a couple of extra years because his brains and total irreverence are an absolute treasure. I wanted our new CEO to have the benefit of his sharp and witty insights. At this latest meeting, he gave Jeff Immelt and me a real zinger for leaking our approval of a deal before he had opined. He wrote derisively, "Since the chairman and chairman-elect, per attributed statements reported by Reuters on Thursday, May 17, 2001, appear to want this, if anyone has an objection at this point, please speak now or forever hold your peace." It took us over 4 hours to go through 11 deals, 5 of them from outside the United States. 9 got approved. One $4 billion acquisition was sent back for a further look, while a $111 million deal to finance 4 office properties in New York City was killed. We've been burned in real estate cycles at least twice. With cranes going up all over New York, everyone was worried about a glut, except Bunt, who did like the deal's structure and conceded, "P.S., I know I'm at risk of Bunt. Are you nuts?" It was one of the few times we didn't go with one of his recommendations. When the meeting broke up, I grabbed a sandwich in the hall and brought it back into a conference room for a strategizing session on our pending acquisition of Honeywell. Dave Calhoun, CEO of our aircraft engine business, had flown in from Cincinnati, and several Honeywell guys had come in from Phoenix for the meeting. We were in the midst of a hearing before the European Commission, which was studying the impact of the deal on competition. Although I had never felt there were any antitrust issues, we were anticipating having to give up some chips to the Commission to get approval of the deal. We needed to know Honeywell's views on the strategic value of each piece. The Honeywell meeting took 2 full hours, pushing back our next scheduled meeting from 1 p.m. until after 3 p.m. This next session was one I always looked forward to because it was all about people, a wrap-up of the Session C field visits over the previous 6 weeks. Human Resources head Bill Connedy prepared the material for the 5-hour meeting. Jeff Immelt took the lead here, and I tried with some success to restrain myself. During our field visits, we often discover 3 or 4 stars in every business and excitedly think up new opportunities for them. When we finally get to this wrap-up meeting, we inevitably find that we've slotted each new star in at least 3 to 5 different jobs. So among other things, this session helps us sort through what we promised in the field and leads to an intense discussion about just which executives will shift from one business to another. We went over the leadership succession plans in each of GE's businesses and discussed plans for executives ranked in the bottom 10%. Sometimes the bottom 10 in one business are better than some of the people ranked in the middle of another business. This always creates a lot of heat. This time, we reviewed the Honeywell integration, including the new organizations proposed for aircraft engines, industrial, and plastics. We spent an hour discussing which positions Honeywell executives would occupy in the post-merged company and who from GE were going to move. We selected the 35 or so managers for the 2001 Top Executive Development Course, EDC, from a nomination pool of about 50. This is a big deal because, in essence, we're signaling to every one of our leaders of the future. For many years, a key part of these sessions had been diversity. This year's detailed summary showed that women and minorities in management have increased by over 70% since 1996. Over 30% of our 3,000-plus executive band employees are diverse. The number of diverse vice presidents was up to 25% in the last year and now represents 16% of GE VPs. That's not Six Sigma yet, but over $30 billion of GE revenues are now being managed by women and minority executives. Our pipeline is building rapidly. Our mentoring program is working. In the last half hour of the meeting, we reviewed the 2 or 3 best practices in each initiative found during the field visits that Jeff would highlight at our CEC meeting in June. The meeting didn't end until after 8 p.m., and the last thing I was thinking about was going back to the damn book. Every day, of course, wasn't this hectic. There's no pat formula to this CEO thing. Everyone does it differently, and there's no right or wrong way to go about it. I certainly don't have a magic formula, but since I was presumptuous enough to write this book, I'll take a shot at sharing some of the ideas that worked for me. I hope some might be helpful. Pick and choose among them, or just toss them all. Integrity. A freshman at a Fairfield University Business School forum recently asked me, "How can you be a good Catholic and a businessman at the same time?" I answered emphatically, "I am." The simple answer is, by maintaining integrity. Establishing it and never wavering from it supported everything I did through good and bad times. People may not have agreed with me on every issue, and I may not have been right all the time, but they always knew they were getting it straight and honest. It helped to build better relationships with customers, suppliers, analysts, competitors, and governments. It set the tone in the organization. I never had two agendas. There was only one way, the straight way. The corporation and the community. Everybody has a view about a corporation's role in society. I do too. I believe social responsibility begins with a strong, competitive company. Only a healthy enterprise can improve and enrich the lives of people and their communities. When a company is strong, it not only pays taxes that provide for important services, it also builds world-class facilities that meet or exceed safety and environmental standards. Strong companies reinvest in their people and their facilities. Healthy companies provide good and secure jobs that give their employees the time, the spirit, and the resources to give back to their communities a thousandfold. Weak and struggling companies, on the other hand, are often community liabilities. They have little or no profits and pay few, if any, taxes. They're tempted to take shortcuts to save a buck, investing little in the development of their employees and workplaces. The constant threat of layoff breeds insecurity and fear in employees whose worries about their own future affect their ability to volunteer time and money to help others. I saw this firsthand in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, where I spent almost all of my first 17 years in GE. In Pittsfield, I saw two types of businesses, one healthy and one failing. We had a vibrant, growing plastics business. We were hiring great people and building new central laboratories. We had an engaged workforce that could give back to the community. Down the street, GE's transformer business had struggled, losing more and more money every year for over a decade. The business had become non-competitive, and we had to close the plants in the 1980s. That money-losing business could provide no long-term help to the community. The town of Pittsfield was angry when we had to shut down the transformer facilities. But this was never about GE or me liking plastics more than transformers or liking one town more than another. This was all about the health of a business and the implications its sickness had on the community. That's why a CEO's primary social responsibility is to assure the financial success of the company. Only a healthy, winning company has the resources and the capability to do the right thing. Setting a tone. The organization takes its cue from the person on top. I always told our business leaders their personal intensity determined their organization's intensity. How hard they worked and how many people they touched would be emulated thousands of times over. The CEO sets the tone. Every day, I tried to get into the skin of every person in the place. I wanted them to feel my presence. When I traveled to remote locations, Europe, Asia, or wherever, the days were 16 hours long, allowing me to touch hundreds, if not thousands, of people. At Crotonville, I've led exchanges with more than 18,000 managers. At every human resources review, I met with the union leaders to understand their concerns so they could understand mine. I didn't want to be a picture in the annual report. I wanted to be someone whom everyone in GE knew. Maximizing an organization's intellect. Getting every employee's mind into the game is a huge part of what the CEO job is all about. Taking everyone's best ideas and transferring them to others is the secret. There's nothing more important. I tried to be a sponge, absorbing and questioning every good idea. The first step is being open to the best of what everyone everywhere has to offer. The second is transferring that learning across the organization. Workout drove boundary-less behavior and developed the ideas. We rigorously evaluated everyone on this value to reinforce its importance. Connecting all the meetings, operating system, from HR to strategy, gave new ideas increased momentum and helped refine them. Crotonville helped share the learning and brought out the best in everyone. Searching for a better way and eagerly sharing new knowledge has today become second nature at GE. People first, strategy second. Getting the right people in the right jobs is a lot more important than developing a strategy. This truth applied to all kinds of businesses. I sat in rooms for years looking at promising strategies that never delivered results. We had great plans for ultrasound, but we could never make them happen until we found the perfect person with ultrasound in his veins. We had service strategies in aircraft engines, power, and transportation for years. Service was always a second-class citizen until we put leaders in place who had the courage to kick ass and break glass. We learned the hard way that we could have the greatest strategies in the world. Without the right leaders developing and owning them, we'd get good-looking presentations and so-so results. Informality. Bureaucracy strangles. Informality liberates. Creating an informal atmosphere is a competitive advantage. Bureaucracy can be the ultimate insulator. Informality isn't about first names, unassigned parking spaces, or casual clothing. It's so much deeper. It's about making sure everybody counts and everybody knows they count. Titles don't matter. There aren't epaulets on shoulders or stiffs in corner offices making all the calls. Just a wide-open spirit where everyone feels they can let it rip. Covering your ass is ridiculed. Passion, chemistry, and idea flow from any level at any place are what matter. Everybody's welcome and expected to go at it. Self-confidence. Arrogance is a killer, and wearing ambition on one's sleeve can have the same effect. There is a fine line between arrogance and self-confidence. Legitimate self-confidence is a winner. The true test of self-confidence is the courage to be open, to welcome change and new ideas regardless of their source. Self-confident people aren't afraid to have their views challenged. They relish the intellectual combat that enriches ideas. They determine the ultimate openness of an organization and its ability to learn. How do you find them? By seeking out people who are comfortable in their own skin, people who like who they are and are never afraid to show it. Don't ever compromise being you for any damn job in any institution. Passion. Whenever I went to Crotonville and asked a class what qualities define an A player, it always made me happiest to see the first hand go up and say, passion. For me, intensity covers a lot of sins. If there's one characteristic all winners share, it's that they care more than anyone else. No detail is too small to sweat or too large to dream. Over the years, I've always looked for this characteristic in the leaders we selected. It doesn't mean loud or flamboyant. It's something that comes from deep inside. Great organizations can ignite passion. Stretch. Stretch is reaching for more than what you thought possible. I've always used the annual budget process as the best example of stretch. You know the drill. There's a business team in the field working for a month on a presentation at headquarters, trying to develop the case for the minimum number they think they could sell. The headquarters team comes to the same meeting armed to squeeze out the maximum. The field team comes with all kinds of charts on the weak economy, the tough competition, and says, we can produce 10. The top management comes in that morning wanting 20. The presentation usually takes place in a windowless room. No customers are present. You know what happens. After mountains of PowerPoint and hours of give and take, the budget is set at 15. It's an enervating exercise in minimalization. The field team flies back high-fiving one another. They didn't have to give all they had to headquarters. Top management thinks it had a great day, ratcheting the objectives to new heights. Why is this game played? Over the years, people everywhere have learned that if you made your number, you got a pat in the back or better, and if you missed your budget, you'd get a stick in the eye or worse. Everyone plays by these rules. In a stretch environment, the same field team is asked to come in with operating plans that reflect their dreams, the highest numbers they think they had a shot at, their stretch. The discussion revolves around new directions and growth, energizing stuff. The team leaves with everyone on both sides of the table having a pretty good understanding of what the business will do and what they'll try to do. An operating plan is put together reflecting that reality. The team knows they're going to be measured against the prior year in relative performance against competitors, not against a highly negotiated internal number. Their stretch target keeps them reaching. We've never yet made a stretch operating plan, yet we've always done a hell of a lot better than we ever thought we'd do, and more than Wall Street expected. A stretch mentality isn't easy to get, and by no means does GE have it throughout the company. Sometimes we found cases where managers at lower levels took stretch numbers and called them budgets, punishing those who missed. I don't think it happens much anymore, but I wouldn't bet on it. Nevertheless, we'll never stop stretching. Celebrations. Business has to be fun. For too many people, it's just a job. I always found celebrations were a great way to energize an organization. From my first day in plastics, I was always looking for ways to celebrate even the smallest victories. At Crotonville, I'd often get frustrated by the answer to the simple question, "Are you celebrating enough?" The students turned silent or would murmur, "No." I love to push back on this one. "Don't look at me. I can't celebrate for you. We're not going to have a vice president of celebrations at GE. You have to consider yourself the manager of celebrations. You've got the authority. Go back and make it happen. You don't have to hand out a new Mercedes. It can be a keg of beer or a dinner for two. Your job is to make sure your team is having fun while they're being productive." Aligning rewards with measurements. You have to get this one right. One time, I was surprised to see a great fourth quarter revenue line and no income to go with it. I asked, "What the hell happened here?" "Well, we had a fourth quarter sales contest and everyone did a great job. Where's the margin?" "We didn't ask for a margin." That's the simplest example of a universal problem. What you measure is what you get. What you reward is what you get. Static measurements get stale. Market conditions change. New businesses develop. New competitors show up. I always pounded home the question, are we measuring and rewarding the specific behavior we want? By not aligning measurements and rewards, you often get what you're not looking for. Differentiation develops great organizations. No one likes to play God and rank people, especially the bottom 10%. Differentiation is as tough an issue as any manager faces. I thought it was my job to talk about it, to force it every day, to demand it from everyone. From my first days, I thought it was the key to building a great organization. For us, the vitality curve made differentiation work. We used it relentlessly to push leaders to continually upgrade their teams. Year after year, forcing managers to weed out their worst performers was the best antidote for bureaucracy. Our survey showed the lower we went in the organization, the louder the concerns about our weakest performers. The lower-level executives, more than senior managers, bore the brunt of laggards. Differentiation is hard. Anybody who finds it easy doesn't belong in the organization, and anyone who can't do it falls in the same category. Owning the people. We always told our business leaders, you own the businesses, you're renting the people. Bill Connedy and I felt we had personal responsibility for the top 750 managers. We looked after their development, their rewards, and their advancement. We ran the people factory to build great leaders. Our business CEOs knew they would be rewarded for teeing up high potentials. Our boundary-less culture changed the game from hoarding your best people to sharing your best. Of course, I'd sometimes hear a groan on the other end of the phone when I'd call a business leader and say, "Sorry, you just lost X." Giving up the best is not a natural act. Within minutes, we'd be talking about the backup slate to fill the new hole we created. With our bench, the backups sometimes turned out better than the starters. Appraisals all the time. Appraisals to me were like breathing. In a meritocracy, nothing is more important. I was giving appraisals all the time, whether I handed out a stock option grant or gave a raise, or even when I'd bump into someone in the hallway. I always wanted everyone to know where they stood. Every year, I'd send a handwritten note with the annual bonus to my direct reports. I'd write 2 to 3 pages outlining what I was looking for in the coming year. I'd attach it to the prior year's letter, which I would mark up in red to give continuity to the process. These notes did a couple of things. I had the chance to reflect on each business and what I thought was important. My direct reports realized that there would be follow-up and that I cared a lot. The process was time-consuming, and sometimes late on a Sunday night, I would wish I hadn't started it, but it was great discipline for me. Culture counts. Kidder sure as hell taught me that. I saw it in the Honeywell-Allied Signal merger. A year after those two companies merged, factions were still arguing over whose culture would dominate. When Daimler-Chrysler came together as a merger of equals, it appeared to lead to confusion. Setting the culture straight on day one minimizes this. The resistors have to go quickly. An organization that truly believes in maximizing intellect can have multiple cultures. During the internet craze of the late 1990s, we had some people in an equity group at GE Capital who suddenly thought they were geniuses. They decided they should have a piece of the action in the companies where they invested GE money. We told them to take a hike. In our shop, there's only one currency, GE stock with GE values. Culture is the reason we passed up a couple of high-tech acquisitions in the late 1990s in California. I didn't want to pollute GE with some nutty stuff going on in the midst of the dot-com craze. That doesn't mean that at GE people can't be individualists or can't get paid extravagantly for great performance. When it comes to personal style and pay, our culture will bend, but we won't break it. Strategy. Business success is less a function of grandiose predictions than it is a result of being able to respond rapidly to real changes as they occur. That's why strategy has to be dynamic and anticipatory. Bob Nelson, my longtime financial analyst and GE's resident history buff, exposed me to this thinking when he passed on an article about the Prussian general Helmut von Moltke. Von Moltke's beliefs brought us to a series of questions that were much more useful to me over the years than all the data crunching in strategic plans. 5 simple questions brought strategic thinking to life for me. What is the detailed global position of your business and that of your competitors, market shares, strengths by product line, and by region today? What actions have your competitors taken in the past 2 years that have changed the competitive landscape? What have you done in the last 2 years to alter that landscape? What are you most afraid your competitors might do in the next 2 years to change the landscape? What are you going to do in the next 2 years to leapfrog any of their moves? Competitors. 2 truths I've learned to challenge over time dealt with competition. 1 old chestnut is, we're losing market share because our competitors are crazy and they're giving the product away. I heard that more than 100 times in my career. Usually it turned out to be BS. The real truth was that a competitor had a better cost position or a strategic rationale for what it did. It took me a while to figure out that I should have been asking, what was wrong with us, not them? The other beauty goes something like this. A team comes in with a proposal to leapfrog the current position of its leading competitor. The implicit assumption is the competition will be sleeping while we're developing the new product. Doesn't usually happen that way. Take our effort to build the GE90 aircraft engine. The engineers convinced me that if we developed this brand new engine for Boeing's new short to medium range 777 jets, we'd meet their requirements for a 90,000-pound thrust engine. They said Pratt & Whitney and Rolls-Royce couldn't stretch their existing technology to get to 90,000. Didn't happen. Pratt & Rolls found ways to get their engines to deliver as much as 94,000 pounds of thrust. Fortunately, the project had a happy ending. Our new engine was capable of getting to 115,000 pounds, which was what Boeing needed when it later came out with a long-range version of the 777. Our engine got us a major contract on these planes. It was tough, but we tried like hell to look at every new product plan in the context of what the smartest competitor could do to trump us. Never underestimate the other guy. The field. I never really felt headquarters was the place to be. and becoming CEO reinforced my point of view. From my first job as an officer in February 1972, I wanted to be out with the people who really made things happen. I'd spend at least a third of my time with the GE businesses. I have no idea how much time CEOs should spend in the field. I do know I fought every day to get my butt out of the office. I always reminded myself, headquarters doesn't make anything or sell anything. Banging around the field was my best shot at getting some idea about what was really going on. Markets versus mindsets. Markets aren't mature. Sometimes minds are. Nowhere was that more truthful than our pursuit with almost religious fervor of a number one or number two fix, sell, or close strategy. Looking at the same businesses from a different share perspective changed our mindset. When we asked each business to redefine its market so they could have no more than a 10% share, what had looked like mature markets became growth opportunities. Even a few field horses started looking like thoroughbreds. With the same portfolio of businesses, our revenue growth rate more than doubled in the last half of the 1990s. Initiatives versus tactics. In 20 years, we really had only four initiatives: globalization, services, Six Sigma, and e-business. Initiatives live forever. They create fundamental change in a company. They build on one another. Everything in the GE operating system reinforces them. On the other hand, short-term tactical moves are needed to revitalize and energize a function or company. Here are three examples. We upgraded sourcing leadership in globalized suppliers. That saved millions. We reduced foreign service employees, FSE, by bringing U.S. expatriates home. That saved millions by forcing the businesses to promote local nationals and put a global face on the company. We reduced internal travel using the internet. That saved millions and addressed the work-life balance issue. Our people got fewer frequent flyer miles but stayed home and had better lives. Understanding the difference between the fundamental and the quick fix helps an organization stay focused. The communicator. I was an outrageous champion of everything we did, from our early need to face reality and change the culture to our major initiatives that reshaped the company. Whenever I had an idea or message I wanted to drive into the organization, I could never say it enough. I repeated it over and over and over at every meeting and review for years until I could almost gag on the words. I always felt I had to be over the top to get hundreds of thousands of people behind an idea. Looking at my handwritten notes from my BOCA speeches over 21 years only reminded me of how many times I said the same things from different angles and with different emphasis. Boundaryless was a clumsy word I could barely get out of my mouth, and I butchered it a million times, but I never stopped saying it. My behavior was often excessive and perhaps obsessive. I don't know if that's the only way, but it worked for me. Employee surveys. We used all kinds of ways to get employee feedback. Crotonville, Session C's, Vitality Curves, and Stock Options. These tools forced management to deal with employees in a straightforward manner. Making employee surveys meaningful was a big breakthrough for us in 1994. We didn't ask about the quality of cafeteria food or the benefit plans. We asked questions that got at fundamental issues around the theme: is the company you read about in the annual report the company you work for? We didn't run the company by polling, but the candor of our employees in these anonymous online surveys really helped us put the right emphasis on the right initiatives. We showed the results not only to our employees, but also to our board members and to the security analysts. The analysts were shocked the first time I did it, but it put a hell of a lot more beef behind the charts I was presenting. Knowing and confronting what was on the minds of our employees was a key part of our success. Upgrading a function. Whenever I thought a corporate function wasn't as strong as it should have been, I would appoint myself the unofficial head of it. Take sourcing, the process of buying billions of parts, products, and services. Sourcing was once a place to park people who hadn't quite made it in manufacturing. In the mid-1980s, when our purchasing costs weren't coming down fast enough, it was clear we needed to change things. I set up a council that brought the business's sourcing leaders to meet with me in Fairfield every quarter. Some of the business CEOs nearly died when they realized whom they were sending. I usually saw the weak ones once. We did the same thing with service leaders, Six Sigma leaders, and e-business advocates, anything that really mattered. Putting the councils together and bringing leaders to Fairfield to meet with me or a vice chairman helped surface the best and brightest from within our organization. Once we had highly energized leaders in place, ideas flowed like water downhill to the rest of the company. The Advertising Manager. Managing image and company reputation is one of the more obvious jobs of a CEO. I might have taken it to an extreme. For 20-plus years, I looked at thousands of storyboards for corporate and product ads. I never allowed one advertisement on the air that I didn't like. We had great two-person advertising teams, led first by Len Vickers and then by Richard Costello. When Len set up a runoff among several agencies for a new GE slogan in 1978, BBD&O won the business. Phil Dusenberry, BBD&O's creative head, came up with GE, We Bring Good Things to Life. I loved it the moment I heard it. Sometimes I drove the agency and our guys nuts with my micromanaging of the process. I liked playing with the ads, had a strong point of view, and wanted to be proud of everything GE put on the air. I thought that Sunday morning TV news programs were the place to reach the country's thought leaders, and most of our ad spending went there. My micromanaging continued. Just months before my retirement, I was reviewing storyboards for TV ads for a new line of energy-efficient refrigerators. Image mattered. I was convinced it was my job. Managing loose, managing tight. Knowing when to meddle and when to let go was a pure gut decision. Although I dove into the tube problem at Medical Systems, I had no involvement in the planning or pricing of our biggest breakthrough in cancer detection, a $2.7 million scanner. A lot of this is pure instinct. I managed tight when I sensed I could make a difference. I managed loose when I knew I had little, if anything, to offer. Consistency was not a requirement here. Sometimes being an undisciplined, unmade bed got the job done faster. You pick and you choose your opportunities to make a difference. I loved to go on the field when I thought I could play, and I loved cheering from the sidelines when I didn't think I belonged in the game. Chart maker. In December of 2000, I was probably the only 65-year-old guy still drawing business charts for analyst presentations. I've always thought that chart making clarified my thinking better than anything else. Reducing a complex problem to a simple chart excited the hell out of me. For every analyst meeting, I'd sit for hours with my finance and investor relations teams, sketching out and tearing up chart after chart. I loved doing charts and got so much out of them. The crazy thing about it was that we always felt the last presentation was our best one ever. Investor relations. Wall Street is a big part of the job. We changed who we put into investor relations. We always had good people, but the old model was a career-ending job for financial types. They were generally at headquarters, expected to respond passively to questions from analysts and investors. The model changed in the late 1980s when we picked young, high-potential financial managers with a marketing sense. Each one of them became the chief marketing officer for GE stock, constantly on the road visiting investors and selling the GE story. The job went from defensive linebacker to offensive halfback. All those who held the job got up every morning and felt they were measured by the price of GE stock. Already on a fast track because of their financial acumen, they used the job to improve their sales and presentation skills. The position went from a dead-end assignment to one of the most sought after. It became a terrific training ground. Warren Jensen, the first of the new model in 1989, went on to become CFO of NBC, then Delta Airlines, and now Amazon.com. Mark Begor followed him, and he's now CFO of NBC. Jay Ireland was next, and he's now president of the NBC Station Group. And Mark Vachon has held the job for the past 3 years. He's been a great sport, agreeing to stay beyond the typical 2 to 3 year run to give us continuity through the CEO transition. Our entire IR team consists of 2 people. That's because our rising stars are supported by a fabulous constant, Joanna Morris, a graduate of our audit staff. Joanna, who always gets teased about training these stars, is married with 2 kids and wanted to settle down in Fairfield without heavy travel. We need only 2 people to tell the GE story, fewer than we had 20 years ago, and now it's launching careers, not ending them. Wallowing. Let's wallow in this was a phrase I often used. It meant getting people together, often spontaneously, to wrestle through a complex issue. The sole ticket for admission was know-how, not titles or positions. We wallowed in public relations problems, environmental issues, BOCA agendas, and big M&A deals. The idea was to get fresh thinking without paper and memos, then sit on the conclusions for a night, wallowing some more. From wallowing came some of our best decisions. It was all about breaking down the concept of hierarchy. Everyone knew they were equal partners at the table, where their ideas could be thrown out with informality and candor. Your back room is somebody else's front room. Peter Drucker gets credit for this one. We practiced it. Don't own a cafeteria. Let a food company do it. Don't run a print shop. Let a printing company do that. It's understanding where your real value added is and putting your best people and resources behind that. Back rooms, by definition, will never be able to attract your best. We converted ours into someone else's front room and insisted on getting their best. That worked for us so many times. This is what outsourcing is all about. It's also what many of our layoffs were about in the early 1980s as these jobs migrated elsewhere. It always made me mad when some politicians and economists claimed that all the job creation in America was coming from small entrepreneurial companies. Much of that, in fact, was the conscious transfer of work out of big business. Speed. At Crotonville, a frequent complaint, even in my final days as CEO, is that we weren't fast enough. I learned in 100 ways that I rarely regretted acting, but often regretted not acting fast enough. I could scarcely remember a time when I said I wished I'd taken 6 more months to study something before making a decision. I think acting decisively on people, plants, and investments was one of the reasons I got out of the pile very early at GE. Yet 40 years later, when I retired, one of my great regrets was that I didn't act fast enough on many occasions. When I asked myself, how many times should I have held off on a decision versus how many times do I wish I'd made that move faster, I inevitably found that the latter won almost every time. Forget the zeros. In a big company, what's small tends to get lost. As businesses and companies grow, their size can become an inhibitor rather than an enabler. The disadvantages of size, the difficult communications, the layers, and the lack of informality all work against the creation of an energizing atmosphere. The entrepreneurial benefits of being small, agility, speed, and ease of communication, are often lost in a big company. Plastics taught me the value of being small, of feeling like you owned it. I came to the CEO job knowing that isolating small projects and keeping them out of the mainstream was the way to grow. We've had many great successes by breaking these projects out and focusing on them as separate smaller businesses in larger entities. We did this everywhere, neural and plastics, CT scanners and ultrasound and medical, and vendor financing and commercial finance and GE Capital. It didn't always work, but in every case, one thing was clear. Breaking out businesses created people who were high-spirited, energized, and backed by the right resources. The smaller ventures got high visibility and created heroes, celebrating both those who won and those who missed, and driving home the value of taking risks. We were aware of what size meant. The worst thing a company can do with size is to focus on managing it. Size either liberates or paralyzes. We tried every day to remember that the benefit of size was that it allowed us to take more swings. Just some thoughts, things that worked for me, along with a lot of luck. For the past 24 years, I have had a lucky charm, a brown leather briefcase that has come with me everywhere. My assistant, Roseanne, has nicknamed it Mr. Lucky. I won the briefcase in an Atlanta golf tournament in 1977, the year I first came to Fairfield. It has seen better days. It's battered and bruised, or as Roseanne liked to say, it's disgusting and looks diseased. I've done extremely well with Mr. Lucky. It's been good to me, and I never wanted to give it up. The only time it's been out of my sight is when Roseanne took it home for a night to stitch a torn seam back in place. It's not that I have never been superstitious. I just never wanted to push my luck. The last day I left headquarters, Mr. Lucky came with me. As my friend Larry Bossidy always said about my briefcase, it's Jack. He doesn't need a new one. That's the one he came with. That's the one he's going out with. Chapter 25, A Short Reflection on Golf. Being CEO of GE was the greatest thrill of my life. If I had another preference, I would have loved to have been a professional golfer. Ever since I picked up the game as a caddy at the Kernwood Country Club in Salem, it's been one of the true passions of my life. My father, who got me started in the game, was right. Unlike the hockey or football I played as a kid, golf was a game I would have all my life. It is a sport that combines what I love, people and competition. The most enduring friendships of my life have been formed on and around the golf course. Every golfer who's ever hit a solid tee shot or has sunk a 14-foot putt knows the seductive power of the game. I was pretty much a self-taught player. I started when I was 9 years old, playing with the older caddies at Kernwood. With a bag filled with half a dozen taped-up clubs, I was lucky to shoot below 120. If I wanted more playing time beyond a few hours on Monday mornings, caddy time, I had to sneak onto the course. In golf, everything seems to happen backward. I would have given my right arm for 5 good clubs back then. Now, people send me free sets of the best clubs, and I've been lucky enough to play in some of the greatest courses in the world. I guess I never lost my touch for caddying. In the summer of 2000, I found myself lugging a bag all over again at the age of 64 for my 7-year-old grandson Jack in a junior tournament at Sankaty Head Golf Club in Nantucket. Little Jack had a better swing than I had for his time out. I grew up with a typical caddy swing, flat, without much style, and with the wrong grip. I just sort of hockeyed the ball around. I never practiced much and just wanted to go out and play. I was co-captain of the team at Salem High and played as a freshman in college. My golfing buddies joke that I take golfing tips from everyone I meet, players, caddies, a locker room attendant, even a waiter at a club. Every tip is worth a try. I'll get the latest ball, the newest driver, anything to get a little more distance. For professional advice, I'd go to Jerry Pittman, the former pro at Seminole, the Great Florida course. I'd ask him, "How do I get 10 more yards in my drive?" "How old are you now?" he'd ask. "How old were you last year? Why don't you realize it?" I don't want to recognize that because I'm convinced I can get better. That's always been the case. Golf is a game where you constantly seek the illusion of perfection. If you enjoy the give and take of a match, and I certainly do, the game is a real high. I can't think of a more social sport. I've met some of the world's greatest human beings playing golf. Many became lifelong friends. John Krieger at the Berkshire Hills Country Club in Pittsfield 40 years ago. Anthony Lofi LaFrisco and Carl Warren at Silver Spring Country Club in Ridgefield, Connecticut 25 years ago. And Jacques Wolfschlager at Sankaty Head 15 years ago. At work, I've had a great foursome over the years in Chuck Chadwell and Dave Calhoun from Aircraft Engines and Bill Madaw from GE Supply. We all play about the same and compete like hell, at least 36 and sometimes 54 holes a day. Some years, their bonus checks have had to be reduced for unspecified reasons. Being CEO of GE gave me access to lots of interesting people on the golf course. The outings made not only for great mornings and afternoons, they made for great stories. I remember one match in Nantucket with Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, and my friend Frank Rooney, who had sold his wife's shoe company to Warren. Bill and I paired up against Warren and Frank. We got to the end of the first hole, and Warren sank a putt for par. "Well," said Bill, "the match is over." "What's this all about?" I asked, confused. Bill explained that he and Warren have an ongoing bet. The first one who gets a par wins a dollar. If they get to the ninth hole without a par, the lowest score wins. Here I was with two of the richest guys in the world, and they were betting a buck on the game. For a second, I thought they were going to walk back to the clubhouse. I had another funny incident that involved Frank Rooney, former chairman of Melville. For years, he's had a contract with Warren to work a day a week. I think he spends every one of those days playing golf. One day, I played with Frank and he shot 78, almost his age, and kicked my butt. Afterward, I sent Warren a note about the game and complained that his employees obviously weren't working hard enough. Warren sent one back. "No Berkshire Hathaway employee can break 80, and I have no recollection of a Rooney on my payroll," he wrote. Golf even got me a GE board member. About 3 years ago, Golf Digest put out a list of CEO golfers and ranked Scott McNealy of Sun Microsystems a number one. Somehow, I was right behind him. Scott soon sent me a challenge. "If I'm going to be number one, I want to be sure I'm number one. Jack, you name the place, anytime, anywhere, mano a mano, and we'll settle it once and for all." I called him the moment I saw his message. We set a date, and Scott was generous enough to come to Nantucket that summer for a 36-hole match, which I won. Within 2 weeks, Scott sent me a trophy inscribed with the words Welch Cup. I beat him again at Augusta the following year over 36 holes to keep the trophy. Last year, he won an abbreviated 18-hole match, and the trophy is now in California. It kills him that I call it an abbreviated match. Only after beating him the first time did I invite Scott on the GE board. It was good timing, just as we were about to launch our e-business initiative. I was lucky. Scott showed up as my game was getting better. Most of my years in golf, I just worked the ball around the course, grinding through 18 holes, surviving only because of my good short game. It wasn't until after I married Jane in 1989 that my game went to a different level. I was up to about a 10 handicap then, but in the process of teaching her the game, I made myself a whole lot better. At one point, I got down to a 2 or 3 handicap and won 2 club championships at Sankaty Head. Before meeting Jane, I'd get knocked out in the first or second round. I wasn't aware of it, but when I began teaching her for the first time in my life, I actually slowed myself down and analyzed my own swing. When I was telling Jane to take a longer backswing, I realized that I had to do the same myself. So I worked on getting it back farther, and I worked on learning how to finish. Until then, I never finished off my swing. Now I keep saying to myself, "Fred Couples, Fred Couples, Fred Couples," when I get ready to take a whack at the ball. I thought Couples had a great finish, and I always try to picture that swing in my head when I'm following through. Teaching Jane helped me to break down each element and focus on the mechanics. By being more aware of the technical stuff, I found that I stopped choking late in the round. I started to play better and began to like the game even more. In 1992, I played 36 holes a day for 10 straight days at Sankaty Head before the tournament. I worked my handicap down to a 2 to win the championship. 2 years later, I managed to win again. It went right down to the wire in a final with my friend Jacques Wolfschlager. He's a terrific golfer. For the past 16 years, we've played 40 to 50 rounds a year together. He can beat me 99 times out of 100. Fortunately for me, my 1 in 100 chance occurred in the 1994 club championship. I won in sudden death, dropping a 15-foot putt on the 37th hole for a birdie. Jacques is someone very special. After losing to me, he spent days carving a wooden Sankaty lighthouse and gave it to me as a memento of the occasion. The most celebrated game I've ever played was in the spring of 1998 at the Floridian, Wayne Huizenga's course in Florida. Matt Lauer, co-host of the Today Show, knew golf pro Greg Norman and asked him to join us. It was a friendly match, and Greg was a great sport playing with a bunch of average players. Greg, just fooling around, shot 70, 2 under par. Matt had a 78. I actually had a lower score than Greg, 69 from the back tees versus his 70 from the pro tips. It was an exciting day for me. I think I told everyone in the world, faxing the scorecard to anyone I knew. At the business council meeting a week later, whenever anyone asked me about my golf game, I said, "Wait a minute," and pulled the scorecard out of my pocket. Greg had a lot of fun with it himself. He signed my scorecard and allowed me to show off, even though it was only a casual game. I told him that by the time I got through telling this story, he will have played the ladies' tees and I will have played the tips. I might have been taking it a little too far, especially after my victory showed up in magazines and newspapers, and even Don Imus began talking about it on the radio. At one point, Greg called and asked jokingly, "Jack, have you told everybody in the world?" "Have you found anyone I haven't told?" I said, laughing. "If so, send me their address." Chapter 26. New Guy. To keep him anonymous, NG is what we called him. It was our code for the new guy. Keeping the choice of my successor a secret was the easy part, but that was the only easy thing about it. Making the pick was not only the most important decision of my career, it was the most difficult and agonizing one I ever had to make. It damn near drove me crazy, causing many sleepless nights. For at least a year, it was often the first thing I thought about each morning and the last thing on my mind at night. What made it so hard was that we had three sensational final candidates. Jeff Immelt, who led our medical systems business, Bob Nardelli, who ran power systems, and Jim McNerney in aircraft engines. All three exceeded every expectation we set for them. Their performance was off the charts. Any one of the three could have run GE. Not only were they great leaders, they were my good friends, and I knew I had to disappoint two of them. I knew it was going to be one of the hardest things I ever had to do. The decision ended a long and obsessive process. Having gone through this myself 20 years ago, I knew what I liked and didn't like about it. If I had run a succession process a few years after getting the job, it probably would have been identical to what Reg did to pick me. His succession was thorough and thoughtful, and it got praise from the academics. Over 20 years, the company had changed so dramatically that I could do it a little differently. From the business-centric model of years ago, GE had evolved into an informal and more tightly integrated organization supported by strong values and rewards. The candidates were all products of this social architecture. They thrived on change and had self-confidence to spare. And our processes, from the quarterly CEC meetings to the day-long session C reviews, brought us together much more often and in much greater depth. I approached the whole process with these thoughts. 1. I wanted my successor to be GE's unquestioned leader. I was concerned about sticking him with disappointed guys who could screw up the spirit and values we worked so hard to create. 2. I wanted to take the politics out of the process. Leadership transitions are an enormous distraction to organizations that need to focus outward, not inward. When I went through the last succession, things became highly political and divisive. Reg didn't intentionally cause the politics, it was the process. By bringing all the candidates to headquarters, he got a closer look at everyone in the race. Tough politics was a heavy price for that look. 3. I wanted to be sure the board was deeply involved in the decision. Going forward, our directors needed to be united behind one person. I had that support in my critical early years. It was a godsend. The board's coaching and support during my down periods, when I was called Neutron Jack and when I struggled with our problems at Kidder Peabody, was incredibly valuable to me. And 4, I wanted to pick someone young enough to be in the job for at least a decade. While a CEO can have an immediate impact, I always felt people should live with their decisions and especially with their mistakes. I certainly had. Someone with less time might be tempted to make some crazy moves to put his stamp on the company. I've seen too many examples of that. Some companies have run through 5 or 6 different CEOs during my years as chairman. I didn't want that to happen at GE. That's what I was thinking about when we started on this road in the spring of 1994. I was 58 then, with 7 years to go. I felt we needed that much time to make the right choice. Picking your successor is hard. Your bet is all about what's ahead, not what's behind. We needed to pick the person who could thrive in a change environment and take the company to the next level, 5, 10, even 20 years out. When I appointed Bill Connedy, our new senior VP for human resources, in November 1993, I told him that our biggest job was to select the next CEO for the company. The thing you and I will both live with for a long time is getting the right person in this job. It was. Little did either of us know.